We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is David Teal, your guest host for the next hour of Focus. The horror film was once epitomized by Gothic castles and Vincent Price, but in the late 60s and the 70s, it gave way to zombies, stalkers, and cannibals in a disorienting mix of the fantastic and the mundane. A new breed of filmmakers, including Roman Polanski, George Romero, John Carpenter, Wes Craven, and Tobe Hooper, collectively took fright features out of the realm of kid stuff and unnerved millions. The stories behind famous terrors from The Exorcist to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, from Rosemary's Baby to Alien, are all featured in the book Shock Value: How a Few Eccentric Outsiders Gave Us Nightmares, Conquered Hollywood, and Invented Modern Horror. Its author is New York Times critic and reporter Jason Zinnemann, who joins us by phone. You're welcome to call in with your questions and comments. The number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the area, anywhere in the U.S., you can use our toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And you can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And with all that out of the way, good morning, Mr. Zinnemann. Welcome to Focus.
Good morning to you. Good to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you. Now, I guess we'll dive right in and ask why horror? Why did you decide to tackle this particular topic?
Moral depravity, the usual. I've always been a rabid horror fan since I was a little kid, And so it's it wasn't something that I I'm a theater critic in my day job, so it wasn't something that I covered that often, but I always loved them. I was always attracted to horror films. I always loved being scared, and I guess the key impetus was I read Peter Biskin's book Easy Rider's Raging Bull, which is a wonderful book about this period in the 60s and 70s. Where this new Hollywood emerged, where directors like Francis Ford Coppola, Martin Scorsese, and made these classic movies that not only reinvented the business of Hollywood, but the art of Hollywood. And my part of what the book did is it, through reporting, it explained how these the behind the scenes of how this happened, not just what was on the movies. And it was a great book, but my only issue with it was it didn't include a lot of the movies that were my favorite movies growing up, which were opening at the exact same period of time. And I think you could even make an argument that the movies that I cover in Shock Value, from Rosemary's Baby and Night of the Living Dead to Alien and Halloween, have had just as lasting and profound an impact as the movies that he writes about, which include, The Godfather and French Connection, et cetera. My goal was to set out to tell the story of how these movies got made. And then once I started by writing a story for Vanity Fair, where I spent about a month reporting it out, and I discovered that there's a lot of great stories here that either haven't been told or there's ways that they haven't been contextualized that I'd like to do.
And, let's talk a little bit about how the horror film was seen prior to this period, because you say that it was in a kind of a waning era at that point.
Yeah, I think, a lot of the key to understanding how these great movies were made is to understand the context in which they were made. And one of the key contexts is just how little respect horror had back then in the mainstream press. And there was a devoted following for horror fans, but at the time, horror was a much smaller genre than it is today. And it was dominated more by stars like Vincent Price and Boris Karloff rather than directors, and I describe it, you know, it was much more of a fantasy genre. It was about much more about the supernatural. And so movies even now that we assume are certainly horror films were not considered horror films when they came out. So a lot of people didn't call Psycho a horror film when it came out in 1960 because a horror film was a movie with supernatural. So anyways, in this period, like 67 is when horror films really were at a low point just in terms of popularity, in terms of quantity of movies coming out. And then 68 is kind of where this shift happens and where I focus in on my book with these three movies, Rosemary's Baby, Night of the Living Dead, and one which is slightly less known, or much less well-known, which is Peter Bogdanovich's Target.
Mm-hmm. And, right, you talk too, about a kind of, there was an anecdote about an appearance by Vincent Price on a talk show. I think it was the Mike Douglas show?
Yeah, that's right.
Right, and where he gets in a kind of tries to defend the horror film and really can't and kind of just goes back into just how it's just fantasy and a lark.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible document. I mean, it's a, you know, I could have used a lot of different examples to demonstrate the state of horror in right before this explosion in 68, but that one is just really startling in both. You know, essentially, Vincent Price is confronted on the Mike Douglas show, which is a pretty unlikely place for it, which the Mike Douglas show with a theme is horror, and he sort of presents horror as, you know, kid stuff and something fun for kids, and he describes horrors about wearing a cape and having spooky music and costumes, and he's sort of selling it as this sort of fun, silly, escapist thing, something not to take too seriously. And then they bring on this psychiatrist, Dr. Frederick Wortham, who is this notorious figure in the history of popular culture. He's probably most famous for testifying against horror comics in the 50s. But he was peddling a book about the danger of horror to kids, and he attacked horror and treated it as a very serious thing, and it's something that actually has a really isn't just fantasy, that affects the real world and has a real impact on people, and is something that we can't just talk about as kid stuff. And, yeah, as you say, Vincent Price just sort of collapsed in the face of this argument, which shows how little confidence people who made horror had in the genre. And ironically, I mean, what you see going forward is that the people who started to make horror films after this in a way sided more with Wortham on one point, which is that horror shifted to be something which was more fiercely realistic. And horror was something to be taken more seriously, and it had deeper resonances, and it had more ambition. And, you know, one of the hallmarks of this period of horror is there's a sort of, a lot of it exists in this blurry line between reality and fantasy, and exploring, you know, Rosemary's Baby is an example. The whole movie, you're trying to figure out whether or not this woman is seeing things as they are, if she's right that she's really having the devil's child, or if, you know, it's all in her imagination.
And our guest during this hour is Jason Zinnemann. He's author of the horror film history book Shock Value. You can call in with your questions at 217-333-9455 or 800-222-9455 if you're out of the area. Let's talk about Rosemary's Baby, because that really does seem like that's kind of where the shift occurs, because you've got the kind of the old horror of William Castle, the producer of many older horror films, trying to do this more realistic film, and that it does seem like that's almost patient zero for this.
No, that, you're absolutely right. I mean, William Castle is a genius, marketer. He directed some good films, and he's but he is probably most famous for coming up with these great gimmicks. And he had the foresight to tell that he got a galley of Ira Levin's book, and he could tell that this was going to be a great movie. And the tragic element of it is that the studio, run by Robert Evans, said, "Well, you can make this movie, but you can't direct." And, you know, Castle saw Rosemary's Baby as his chance for respectability, as for making a movie that could win Academy Awards, et cetera. So, and instead, the studio said, look, we'll bring this on, but we'll hire, you know, kind of someone who has one foot in the, you know, in the art house, European art house. Polanski, who had made a few scary movies like Repulsion, which, you know, really have some gorgeous visual imagery. And Polanski really rooted it in a sense of place and time, and you know, really created, made the environment of that apartment probably the scariest thing about it. And yeah, I mean, that's an example where, you know, he was most interested in subjectively locating this movie in the point of view of Rosemary. And in doing that, and you can scare the audience through all these interesting other ways. So you have this, you know, and a lot of cases, the way my book is structured is, you know, a lot of these movies are arguments between two aesthetic sensibilities. So, you know, this one you have kind of the old horror, which, you know, the subject matter is, you know, the story of the devil. Devil's Child is this, you know, old supernatural story, and then you have this new aesthetic, Polanski, and so occasionally they fit hand in hand, occasionally they butt heads, sort of. So there's discussion at the end about, you know, whether to show the devil at the end, and you know, at the end they go for a more restrained route, although some thought it should be more restrained, not show anything. But I would say there were a lot of people, you know, who are, say, more influenced by Hitchcock, who, you know, would rather show less. And anyways, but that's I think in a lot of ways what I discovered through doing reporting of the book is that the auteur theory has made most people look at these movies merely through the lens of the director. And while that is incredibly important, in a lot of cases, the screenwriter or you know, other people working on the film or various other traditions are just as important.
And you mentioned Hitchcock, of course, you know, for a long time was seen as, you know, the master of suspense, and certainly had built up that kind of, you know, reputation or kind of mythologized himself, I think. And, you know, in your book, it seems like most of these filmmakers were at once influenced by Hitchcock, but then were trying to kind of break away from him as well.
Yeah, that was something that surprised me. I mean, you know, my goal for the book was not to, you know, the book in a lot of ways, there's some criticism in it, and but it's rooted in reporting. And my goal was to kind of follow where the reporting goes. And so I talked to hundreds of people and who made these movies, and one of the things that really surprised me is, of course, they were, you know, they loved Hitchcock, and they're incredibly influenced by Hitchcock, and Hitchcock just invented a vocabulary for suspense that, you know, nobody else ever had. And so, but I was surprised by how many of the people who made the great horror films from this period had criticisms of Hitchcock that found their way into their movies. One element is this element that, you know, Hitchcock movies were relatively discreet in what they showed in terms of gore, and you know, Hitchcock's idea of suspense as often hinges on what you don't show. And this was a period when a lot of things were opening up in the movies, that you could say things that you couldn't say before, you could show things you couldn't show before. There was a certain political push because of Vietnam to show violence in a way that the news media wasn't. So people wanted to be more explicit with violence than they were. So in that sense, they were breaking away from Hitchcock. But in another way, the last scene in Psycho comes up a lot. You know, people like William Friedkin and Peter Bogdanovich, and people who, again, who really respect and love Hitchcock, Craven. The last scene of Psycho, the scene where the doctor kind of explains Norman Bates, medicalizes the evil in the movie. And, you know, some people see that as letting the audience off the hook, that the scariest thing would be to not explain the evil. That by giving it, you know, a diagnosis, that, you know, you sort of put it in a box and it's safe. Well, what you see in a lot of these movies in this period in the late 60s and 70s is that the movies end either on an unhappy ending, or more likely just on a kind of ambiguous ending or on an ending of random violence or something which is sort of unresolved. And I think that's another hallmark of this period, the sense of disorientation, of uncertainty, of anxiety, that there, you know, a resistance to the kind of pat beginning, middle, and end structure.
And, you know, one movie, of course, another movie you talk about is coming out in 68, and of course, being very, very influential, I think, is Night of the Living Dead. And that was a movie that, at least for a time, kind of also tried to not have an explanation for what was going on.
It did. I mean, it actually ended up, there was a sort of interesting discussion. You know, there is like a, I think it's in a news report in the movie where they have this sort of silly explanation of this how the zombies came to be, but there was a discussion on the set about whether or not to have an explanation or to keep it totally unknown, and in the end somebody piped up, so no, there's always in these 50 sci-fi movies where the aliens attack, there's always that one monologue where somebody says, explains, what the aliens want to do, or there's some scientific hubris or something. There's always that explanation, and I think that. So, Night of the Living Dead is unquestionably, probably the most influential. I doubt there's a more influential movie from this period, and the zombie. It's funny. George Romero didn't use the word zombie in the movie. He didn't use it in the. When it came out, it was only when people started reviewing it. But he essentially invented, what we know of as zombies now. These flesh-eating creatures who don't, who not only going to kill you, but there's a sort of apocalyptic sense that they're taking over the world. You see that now in The Walking Dead. And all over the place. That was hugely important. Also, the fact that there was a African American protagonist who, was this heroic figure who was fighting off all the zombies, who then randomly gets killed at the end by law enforcement after he, kills all the zombies, through a kind of sheer accident. Gets gunned down at the end of the movie. I mean, that's the kind of dark, dark irony that pops up, particularly in Romero's movies, but that pops up in the horror movies of this period. The hero who triumphs gets killed not for any reason that can be explained. And I think that the insight there is that. The world view it paints is like the world is this vast, incomprehensible place, that's a very scary, scary thought.
We are talking this morning to Jason Zinnemann. He's a author of the book Shock Value, about the birth of the modern horror film. The number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. And then, of course, you can use our toll-free line, 800-222-9455. You can also email us questions at will-talk@illinois.edu. And now, getting back to Night of the Living Dead here for a moment, I guess one of the things that I had always read about it was that it seemed like it was a kind of subversion of so many of the tropes of these kind of films that you have a hero whose suggestions aren't, you think that he's right because he's the hero, but he actually comes up with some dumb ideas that help get them killed. The heroine, is just a babbling wreck for the whole movie and things like that. Was that something that Romero was specifically trying to accomplish?
Yeah, I think he was. I mean, I think the movie is, it's really about survival. I mean, the people, you're talking about things that usually gets ignored, but you're right. I mean, there's all these arguments about whether they should go downstairs, they should go upstairs, and people, the decision-making process isn't always so rational and gets out of hand. And it's really about, part of me, when you read the reviews of The Walking Dead, the AMC series. That, mm-hmm. that show gets a lot of credit for the fact that it's not about killing, but it's really about the challenge of survival in extreme circumstances. And I guess the only thing that bothers me about that is, you know, I think you could say the same thing about Night of the Living Dead. That Night of the Living Dead is just as seriously about those survivors and about the relationships between all those characters in the house. And I don't think it's, you know, frankly, that less any less complex than The Walking Dead is. And yeah, I mean, so and especially if you compare it to, you know, so many horror films where the victims are completely interchangeable. And you know, and you know, you couldn't care less about, you know, where, you know, what happens to them or what their point of view is.
And you had said too in the book, and this is something I had always heard about, you know, the political subtext of Night of the Living Dead. That's something that you just always, as somebody who, you know, who's seen a lot of horror films, read about a lot of horror films, you always hear that, and it sounds like it was completely unintentional.
Yeah, I mean, it was just, you know, there's only so many good actors in Pittsburgh in the late 60s they had access to, and the best guy for the job was this guy Dwayne Jones. And, I mean, all, you know, a huge amount of political readings was put on this movie. Now, I don't think it, the question, the sort of interview, I'm not sure it matters that much. And whether, I mean, the intention, in a lot of cases, some of the best things about these movies were not intended. And I think that's just the way art works, that sometimes, you know, some of the best things happen by accident. And frankly, I find that kind of like an inspirational thing, because if you look at the history of horror, a lot of these political readings were done by, you know, fans and the audience members. And Romero heard them, and in response, in his next zombie movie, you know, he did set out to add a political message to it. And I think Romero, who when he made Night of the Living Dead, you know, wasn't excited about making a horror film. He actually did it because he couldn't get the movie he wanted to make off of the ground. I think he ended up making a much more. He made a movie called Martin, which is a fantastic vampire movie, really ambitious. And Dawn of the Dead, and he made other ones as well, but these ones I'm just singling out. And then Dawn of the Dead, which is a movie which has much more explicit in politics and clearly is about, you know, consumerism. It's set in a shopping mall. So, you know, what you see there, often you hear that when artists listen to audience members or when they try to anticipate what audience members want, that's pandering. But here's a case where because when an artist listen to what the audience members' response, or, you know, smart audience response, they ended up making better work. And, you know, I think it's just, that's not to say it's always like that, but I think these things are often much more complicated than they're presented.
I'd like to maybe talk a little bit about The Exorcist. Yeah, because that's another one. It's not. It's a little later. I think what, 73.
That's right.
73. So, but this was kind of a major clash over between the filmmakers over kind of how the vision was supposed to come out, and I guess it's a fight that kind of went on over the years, right?
Yeah, it went on for. I mean, and it's, you know, different people won over the various couple decades, but yeah, the. I actually just saw they had a screening of it, which I spoke at last week up in New York, in upstate New York. And the movie is a gorgeous movie. It's a beautiful movie. I saw the revised version. The original version is quite different than the version they re-released in, I think it was 2000. And to understand those differences, you need to understand this dispute between William Peter Blatty, who was the writer of the book and the writer of the screenplay and the producer, and the director, William Friedkin. And that's the story I focus on in the book, where you have Blatty, who is a very religious, devout guy, wrote the book, you know, from this, you know, as the spiritual document. And you know, he felt that if people believed in, demons, then they can believe in God. And this was, he had, this was not like a cheap trick. This was not like Ira Levin's Rosemary's Baby. William Friedkin wanted to, make like a great suspense movie, and he was a secular Jew who came from Chicago, and that was, he told, Blatty on the set, I'm not making a commercial for the Catholic Church. Now, where this dispute manifests itself concretely in the making of the movie is in questions like, well, the sort of central question of the movie, which is one of the central questions, why does the devil or the, choose this girl in Georgetown at this time? And in the book, it's much more clearly a question of, that he's challenging the faith of this priest who has some doubts and whose mother just passed away. And in the original movie, a lot of that was trimmed out, and the ending was made, but ended just with the guy on the steps after he fell down. And Blatty hated it. Blatty hated the cut that Friedkin made. Friedkin essentially won most of these battles. And Blatty felt that it looked like the devil won at the end. I think Friedkin was coming from the idea that, this is what we were talking about before, the ambiguity is better, and rooted in an interest in Harold Pinter and that kind of menace. But what happened was in 2000 when they re-released it, they recut it and added the ending that Blatty wanted, and they added some of those explanatory scenes, and it ended with this this sort of light exchange, which it's sort of irrelevant what they talked about, the character talked about, but what it communicated was that things were okay. Arguably, what it communicated was a similar thing to the last scene in, not exactly analogous, but to Psycho, which is sort of the madness has ended. Now this last scene takes place in the daytime, and they're talking about the detective, Kinderman, is talking about going to the movies, and, all the world, the order has been restored, in this sort of like... it's a pretty significant change. It's really essentially this disagreement over religion, and it's important because I think a lot of the impact of that movie when it came out has to do with, religious people had a incredibly, profound reaction to this movie. And it was a colossal success. I mean, it really mainstreamed horror in a way that nothing else has. That had before that. It was another example of something which really broke away from the idea that horror was anything cheap or lowbrow. I mean, the cast of that movie was, Max von Sydow and Lee J. Cobb, who played the original Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman, Ellen Burstyn. I mean, a fantastic cast. It looked beautiful. The sets were incredible. The first scene of the movie is in Iraq, which is just incredibly expensive on location shoot. So it just right away you get the sense this isn't something that was done in the back studio lot. This is a prestige studio film, and although Friedkin didn't admit it at the time, and it's horror. So that was something new.
We are going to take a quick break here. When we get back, we'll talk about Halloween, Alien, and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But right now, we're going to take a short break.
On the next Fresh Air, Allison Pearson talks about her novel, I Think I Love You, about a girl obsessed with David Cassidy. It's just come out in paperback. The film adaptation of Pearson's other novel, I Don't Know How She Does It, opens this weekend. It stars Sarah Jessica Parker as a mother trying to keep up with her child and her high-pressure job. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Jason Zinnemann. He's author of the horror film history book, Shock Value. And you can call in with your comments and questions at 217-333-9455 or toll free at 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. One of the unsung heroes, I thought, in your book turns out to be this gentleman named Dan O'Bannon. And I kind of wanted to hear about your take on the relationship between him and John Carpenter, who's probably better known as the director of Halloween and many other horror films over the years. Can you get back into maybe their relationship and what was really the importance of Dan O'Bannon?
Yeah, he was the guy who I barely knew going into reporting this book, but his name kept coming up. And, you know, what I learned is that, you know, because he had directed very few directing credits, I think he had gotten less attention than he deserved. But basically, he met John Carpenter at USC Film School in the late 60s. Carpenter noticed this short film he made called Bloodbath, which was really striking, about a man who commits suicide in the bathtub. And they became friends because they shared a lot of the same interests. They both loved the movie The Thing, Howard Hawks movie. They liked H.P. Lovecraft. They had a lot of the same interests, and they wanted to make, they liked 2001. They wanted to make a movie, so they set out to make a movie, Dark Star. That was John Carpenter's first movie, which, you know, was really, O'Bannon deserves probably just as much credit as Carpenter does. Carpenter got the directing credit, but they both did a little bit of everything. What I do in the book is I sort of try to track down as many of their classmates as I could and try to explore, the sort of origin of their intellectual life. Because what happened was Carpenter would go on and make Assault on Precinct 13 and then Halloween, which is, of course, you know, one of the most ripped-off movies of all time, which helped sort of spawn the 80s slasher craze. And O'Bannon would write the screenplay for Alien and bring on Giger to design the monster and, you know, create one of the greatest, probably the greatest new monster, since the 30s. And O'Bannon then went on to make, he also worked on Star Wars, did special effects for Star Wars. George Lucas also went to USC. And O'Bannon directed Return of the Living Dead, which was a wonderful zombie movie in the 80s. It's one of the early kind of zombie comedies, which includes fast zombies, one of the first movies to include fast zombies. What I try to do is sort of show how their relationship impacts their work. They were very different personality types. Carpenter was much more he was much more confident and knew what he wanted and came from knew he wanted to be a filmmaker early on, made short films. O'Bannon actually came from like a fine arts background, wanted to be an artist, and was a little more eccentric and wasn't as good at sort of playing the game. The generous way to put it is he wasn't the most diplomatic guy. And he paid for it, that he got kicked off the set of Alien and he had trouble getting work. And, where you compare it to Carpenter, Bannon would get involved in these incredible projects like Dune, and then where he, it would never come to fruition. Where Carpenter was very savvy about his career and knew, put his name above the title and to get a director's credit. But I do think that they had a huge falling out, and O'Bannon passed away last year, and they ended, so the relationship was very strained. But I think that they both helped each other's careers. They're both brilliant filmmakers. And I think they, and a lot, if you talk to Carpenter, you say, what's the most influential thing in your career? He'll say his time at USC. And I think for O'Bannon, that was also a hugely influential time. And I think, you know, the things that they talked about, whether it's H.P. Lovecraft or The Thing, they show up in the rest of their career, or, you know, their ideas about character that shows up in Carpenter's version of The Thing, in Carpenter's later movies like They Live. I think it's a really interesting relationship that tells you a lot about, you know, the horror genre as it is today.
And, you know, we should talk about Halloween because, I mean, that is the film that Carpenter was probably, well, I would guess best known for, although there's been a lot of films over the years. And as you say, that was a pretty frequently ripped off film. But what do you see as the elements that, you know, that really people kind of took in as the new tropes of the horror film from that film?
Well, I guess like the first thing, right, is the point of view shot. You know, the movie has that long tracking shot where you're from the killer's point of view outside the house. That beautiful gliding shot that goes up the stairs. You know, that became the way that he moves from the killer's point of view to the victim's point of view and back and forth, and how, you know, that was really elegant and hugely important. I mean, I think Carpenter, in a lot of ways, you know, the thing about Halloween is that the plot of the movie doesn't matter so much, or the way to put it is that the real narrative of the movie has to do with the shift in point of view. That's how I see it. It's very incredibly clever in that movie. I think the final girl, you know, people talk about how these slasher movies always end with one female survivor who fights off a killer. You know, that's certainly, Jamie Lee Curtis is a key figure in that. The music in Halloween is incredible. You know, Chris Carpenter wrote that, you know, is incredibly influential. Everything from, you see this new movie that came out, Attack the Block, which is a great, relatively low-budget English alien movie. The music is influenced hugely by Halloween still today. Same with Super 8, J.J. Abrams' movie. You know, everyone talks about how that movie is aping Spielberg, but the first reference of that movie, you see a poster for Halloween, and that's not an accident. I think that all those elements are things that are, you know, the kind of body count serial killer movie, The Guy with the Mask, those are all things that pop up, although it wasn't the first, you had Leatherface. If you ask me what I think the reason the movie, what didn't get ripped off as much, and which I think is what made the movie so radical and wonderful, is the psychology of the killer, Michael Myers, which is to say, he has none. He's a very odd figure. That basically Carpenter sets up this very realistic setting in middle American suburbia, and then in the middle of he puts this character who is sort of like an anti-character. He's like an absence of a character. He doesn't really walk like a human being, but he's not a ghost either. He doesn't seem to kill because he likes to or because he has any reason to kill. He's completely mysterious. He doesn't seem to get angry. He has no backstory for the most part, except for that first scene, which doesn't tell you much of anything. This was a way, as I see it, for Carpenter to show you the killer, but to preserve this sense of the unknown, the mystery of evil. And that, I think, is what the movie's about. It's about evil. And you know that's a theme that's not going away. You know that's why these movies are, you know, hugely popular today, and they'll be hugely popular 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now. You know, the themes about Vietnam may or may not be relevant, or as they won't resonate as strongly, but a theme about evil will.
Our guest in this hour is Jason Zinnemann, author of the horror film history book Shock Value. And of course, we're welcoming your comments and questions at 333-9455 or toll-free at 800-222-9455. You had mentioned Texas Chainsaw Massacre a moment ago as just kind of the genesis of that kind of masked killer. And I thought one of the things that you said in the book that intrigued me was the idea that the mask in some of these movies doesn't so much disguise the killer as it does actually give him a personality.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's certainly true in the next decade. I mean, Freddy or something became, you know, his knives and his hat became who he was. I mean, that's how he knew him. You know, you would even, and the hockey mask for Jason, that's who he was. You know, each movie wasn't about developing his character more. It was about showing you this iconic image, and that would tell you who he was. And I would say Texas Chainsaw has, you know, Texas Chainsaw, I think, is a better movie. By the way, I think if you look back in the 60s in the Italian giallo movies, you see a lot of masks that function like this. That they tell you about that there's a kid. That was a trope in a lot of these Italian movies. But the interesting thing is that the character of Leatherface, who wears the mask, and who's based on a real life serial killer, who would cut the skin off his victims and wear it, is, I think, slightly more complicated and slightly more sympathetic than first appears. I think there's, especially in that last dinner scene, you see that the movie is also about the dynamic of his family, where he's being bullied by people in his family, and he's sort of doing their dirty work. He's essentially getting their food. Now, in getting their food, he's killing people and doing horrible things, so I'm not making excuses for him. But there's elements of, there's like a long tradition of the sort of sympathetic monster, going back to Frankenstein. And I think that, that there is a bit of that in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and that makes it a more, that adds a layer of depth to it.
Yeah, you commented too that it doesn't. It's not as gory as you think. It's a film that's built a reputation on being really really gory, but a lot of it's unseen.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you name a movie Texas Chainsaw Massacre, it doesn't matter what's the movie, people are going to think it's incredibly gory. I mean, that evokes a lot. But there's definitely a lot of violence to it, but I think it's a credit to Tobe Hooper in that movie that people think they see a lot more on-screen violence than there is. There's, maybe a few drops of blood, but there's even like the most famous death scenes in that movie, like when Leatherface puts a woman on a hook. You never see that. What you see is you see him pick up the woman, you see him bring, you see a shot of the hook, and then you see him pick her up, and then the camera pans down to a bucket. And, you never see blood fall in the bucket, but the implication is because the bucket's there to collect the blood. And it's a classic, that's a great piece of like, film language right there, of cinematic storytelling, where, you're supposed to connect this narrative that the bucket was there to collect the blood in your mind. He doesn't show it to you. He doesn't show, the way that without would be made today is you'd see the hook going through the skin and people would scream, and then you'd see the blood dripping down into the bucket, and then it would be handled much more crudely. See, now, still, it's an incredibly intense scene, and it's disturbing, no question. But actually, there's much more elements of indirection and suspense in that movie than people think. It's so damn good at it that people don't realize it.
Yeah, and just touching back on you said that the idea of the sympathetic monster. I mean, you make a case for the fact that this whole family is itself kind of sympathetic in that they're this dysfunctional family, and they're a disappearing class of people that they've been pushed aside by technology, and this is what's brought them to some pretty unsavory things.
Yeah, they were laid off they used to kill these animals, and they, the advances in technology made them obsolete. And there's, and their way of life is threatened. And you know, they see these like, city kids coming from outside as representative of that. Now that's all really legit, but that's all in the conception. You know, of when Kim Henkel and Toby Hooper came up with the story, that was part of it, that they wanted to figure out, like, they're from Texas and they knew these these scary backroads of Texas, and they wanted to come up with a plausible type, these sort of like hillbilly types who would have all this resentment. Now then, once they have this type, which is rooted in something real, then they add the element of, extreme, horror to it, which is that they eat people. But, if you take away the fact that they, they kill them and they eat them, that's not so hard for people to understand. Today more than anything else, you have these places where putting people out of work, a lot of unemployment, and you're sitting around with your family, and your pride is all revolved around this work which you no longer have. I think it's rooted in something real. And same with the dynamics within the family. The relation between the father and the brothers, that's also, while it's on this incredibly extreme operatic, Grand Guignol scale, the family dynamics in that scene are very real. And in a way, that last scene works like a one-act play. So I think Texas Chainsaw actually, it's probably my favorite of all these movies. It's the one where it's not as scary to me as the first time I saw it, but it rewards multiple viewings.
We have about 5 minutes left in the program. We've been talking this hour to Jason Zinnemann, author of the book Shock Value. And one thing that really struck me, and part of this may be just me feeling old, but we're talking about modern horror here. I mean, that's what the premise of this book is. This is where modern horror began, and yet we're really going back to 68. 68 is 43 years ago. That's Rosemary's Baby and Night of the Living Dead, and then on into the 70s here. But I mean, these are still 40-year-old movies. And yet, I think you're making the case here that these are still very much in, what modern horror is.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit. Anytime you say modern horror, you could say it's a little bit arbitrary. Certainly, the Universal horror films, Frankenstein, Dracula, Jekyll and Hyde. Those movies, you could argue, those are the beginning of modern horror. There's great movies, and obviously great movies in the 50s, and Val Lewton made some spectacular movies in the 40s. But I do think that in terms of cultural impact having to do on movies and culture today, these movies have an influence out of proportion. And you see it in a movie like, say, Black Swan. That movie seems to me a descendant of, Polanski and De Palma movies in the 60s and 70s. Or in Coen Brothers movies like No Country for Old Men, the killer in that movie has a similar psychological profile to Michael Myers. As I write in the book, if you look in, political campaign ads now seem to echo the tropes from these movies from the 60s and 70s. Now, there is also a movement today because horror has gotten so vast, and I think there's another kind of business element, subplot to this, and the business of horror. But there's a, reverting back to the original monster movies. Obviously, vampires and werewolves are everywhere these days, and they were around before this period. But they have a much longer history. Vampires, there's all this talk about the resurgence of vampires. The truth is, vampires have never gone away. Even in this period, in the 60s and 70s, the most famous horror films were not vampire movies, but there was many, many, many vampire movies made during this period. So that's just sort of an evergreen. I think the difference is that until not so long ago, people talked about there being like horror cycles. Like, oh, now we're in a, you know, the Scream has brought back a horror cycle, and now there's meta horror. That, I think, is finished. Now horror is just a part of the cultural menu, and it's not going away. It's the kind of meat and potatoes of Hollywood. There's a huge amount of it on TV. It's, you know, the most popular shows on the major prestige cable channels. There's a huge industry of horror in independent film. It's increasingly even in things like theater. The publishing industry is, huge number of horror films that are crossing over into mainstream fiction. The reason I think the book is relevant is I think to understand popular culture today, you can't do as, I think what, like my parents, for example, just took no interest in this. I don't think you could do that anymore if you want to understand popular culture. You don't have to understand it, but to understand popular culture, you can't just turn a blind eye to horror anymore. It's just too large.
Just in terms of recent films, are there ones that really strike you as being maybe influencing future generations, or just maybe just a bloody good time?
Many of my favorite recent ones are low budget movies that that haven't gotten a huge release. There's a movie called I Can See You, which I just saw, which is a beautiful movie that was made about one year ago, about it has like a very classic horror setup, which is city kids who go out into the country and terrible things happen. But what's different is that it seems like more like a David Lynch film. It has a kind of a surreal edge to it, which is very different than a lot of these movies we're talking about. It's not realistic. That was a great movie. I think in terms of bigger, Attack the Block is a great movie. I mean, that's a great popular, crowd-pleasing alien movie. I'd recommend that heartily. And that's just a bloody good time. But it's also a smart, I mean, it's sort of like an alien movie meets The Wire. It's set in the projects of South London. And it has a, some characters, these poor black kids who are much more interesting and complicated than you originally think they are when they first appear on the screen. So I think I would recommend Attack the Block. Those are the two popped to mind.
Well, great. Thank you very much. That is unfortunately the end of our hour. We're out of time. Our guest in this hour of focus has been Jason Zinnemann. He's the author of Shock Value, which is available in hardcover from Penguin Press. I enjoyed it very much. I want to thank you, Jason, for being my guest today.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
Thank you.
It's like a very classic horror setup, which is city kids who go out into the country and terrible things happen. But what's different is that it seems like more like a David Lynch film. It has a kind of a surreal edge to it, which is very different than a lot of these movies we're talking about. It's not realistic. That was a great movie. I think in terms of bigger, Attack the Block is a great movie. I mean, that's a great popular, crowd-pleasing alien movie. I'd recommend that heartily. And that's just a bloody good time. But it's also a smart, I mean, it's sort of like an alien movie meets The Wire. It's set in the projects of South London. And it has a, some characters, these poor black kids who are much more interesting and complicated than you originally think they are when they first appear on the screen. So I think I would recommend Attack the Block. Those are the two that popped to mind.
Well, great. Thank you very much. That is unfortunately the end of our hour. We're out of time. Our guest in this hour of focus has been Jason Zinnemann. He's the author of Shock Value, which is available in hardcover from Penguin Press. I enjoyed it very much. I want to thank you, Jason, for being my guest today.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
Thank you.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Burlingame Home Inspection and Performance. Burlingame performs property inspections along with energy audits and ratings for Energy Star, tax credits, and efficiency mortgages, all utilizing infrared technology. More information is at CUSaveEnergy.com or 217-649-1173.
And in the minute before 12 o'clock, I'm Jeff Bossert, your host for the Afternoon Magazine, with this market update from Kansas City. Hard red winter wheat for December at 787 and a quarter, down 8. Minnesota December wheat, 693 and a quarter, down 2 and 3 quarters. In Chicago, December corn at 694 and 3 quarters, down 6 and a quarter. March, 708 and a half, down 6 and a quarter. November soybeans, 1354 and 3 quarters, down 4. January, 1366, down 4 and a quarter. Now down 3 and a quarter, not down 3 and a quarter for January. October soybean meal, 348.60, down 1. October soybean oil, 58.26, that's up 4. October live cattle, 119.20, up 30. September feeder cattle, 135.52 and a half, down 7 and a half. October lean hogs, 87.90, that's down 110.